the University of Rochester Press, which has been lovely to work with, will publish it on June 17th. It's my third book, and it's quite different from the other two. The other two were short essays about individual songs. This one has an overriding narrative, and it's called City Songs and American Life, 1900 to 1950. And as with any book, there are some things that nobody else will notice but make me squirm and itch. But all in all, I have to say I'm pleased with it. And I think the people at the press have treated it with great respect. I'm very happy with them. They're good people. And who do their job, do an important job and do it well. They are editors.
So we'll be looking forward to hearing more about that.
Well, I'm going to put it in the basket with my jams and jellies and go door to door.
That's great. I wanted to talk a little bit about, if you want to, how do you define the American Popular Songbook from your perspective? What are the dates of it?
Sure. The Great American Songbook generally is thought to be 1920 to 1950. And you know as well as I do that those dates are, any dates, arbitrary and artificial. They're useful, but they're not accurate. I mean, My Fair Lady was 1956. Are you telling me it's not part of the songbook? Of course it is. So it's basically from the end of one war to the end of another war. And the great wall that goes up is rock and roll in the early 50s. But in the 50s, Tony Bennett is still singing. So Sinatra's career resumes after a downtime in the early 50s. So it's not so much accurate as it is useful. And then you have before it the great formative influences of ragtime, jazz, and the blues, without which there would be no American sound. What's really happening, I think, is that African American music, obviously, is not an influence. You know, the Swedes come over and bring their music. The Russians come and bring their music. The Italians come and bring their music. But African American music is not an influence, as everybody else is. You know, that's great. The country is this great mess of people. It's our glory. It makes things tough sometimes, but it's our glory. The African Americans really are at the heart of it. Mm-hmm. They're the protoplasm. They're not an additional great influence, but they don't have access. Even after emancipation, after the Civil War, they don't have access. The Jews arrive. They're looking for... The Jews, when they got here, were like water. They went wherever there was an opening. J.P. Morgan was not hiring Mr. Goldberg. But Tin Pan Alley didn't care if his name was Goldberg as long as he could write hits. And vaudeville didn't care if his name was Goldberg or Cantor, Eddie Cantor, as long as he could entertain audiences. So you went where the openings were, and Jews, with other peoples as well, gravitated to show business. And a lot ended up in Tin Pan Alley. And so what they were doing was translating black music so that the rest of America could listen to it, embrace it, get it. Did they smooth the rough edges? Sure, because they were writing for the broad population rather than for a contained group writing for one another. And so the great gift of African American music,
including minstrel shows, by the way.
No, they were all written by whites.
Oh, okay.
They were all written by whites.
Okay.
They go back to the 1830s.
Okay. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
You've got the great gift of African-American syncopation. Now, syncopation is a lot older than what African-Americans were doing, but it was that particular loose syncopation, there we go again, that African-Americans had in cakewalks and work songs. And it influenced jazz. And white songwriters heard early jazz, and they picked up on the syncopation to the point where some writers about American popular music, when they're writing about the ballads, the love ballads, they don't call them love ballads or romantic ballads. They call them syncopated ballads. And you find it in the words, too. The words used to syncopate. And so you have, what shall I do? You've left me. What shall I do? That's first line in the song. What Irving Berlin figured out was you make those first notes a triplet rather than bum, bum, bum. It becomes da-da-dum. And you use slang and contraction, and it becomes speech. What'll? What'll I do? And you, what shall I do is a question you ask in the middle of giving an oration. What'll I do is something when you say to yourself when you can't sleep at night.
Right.
There it is, right there.
Yeah.
In three notes, three words. And it's on, the song is on its way. It's in motion. What shall I do is static. What'll I do is moving. There's the craft. There's the craft that's so masterful, it's invisible.
Fascinating Rhythm is kind of a legacy, really, for the art form of American popular song, where it might fit in some way in the media world or just in the art world in general.
Well, obviously, we're not going back. You don't go back. Will singers continue to sing some of these songs in the way that rock singers have done, crossed over? Willie Nelson has two or three CDs. He's not a rock singer, but two or three CDs. And some of the stuff he does from the songbook is quite good, I think. But the I never thought much about legacy until I got old. And I knew some of the people in the library at Nazareth College. And so I chatted with them, and the chatting turned into talking with them. And now when I do a show, I get a CD copy of that show. There's the station's master copy, and I get a copy. After I die, all of my scripts, all of my playlists, all of the recordings that I have will go to the Nazareth Library. And I chose Nazareth, first of all, because they were very nice, but also because it's the only place in town that has both a music and a theater major. And they'll also get all of the materials for my three books, you know, all my notes and drafts. And I have a pretty good library now of music and theater books, hundreds of them. And they'll go to the library. So I'm pleased to know that at least there'll be a chance for young people to hear these songs.
Well, I'm looking forward to your new book.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to many more shows and I, by the way, am enjoying the evening repeat on Saturdays.
Yes,
that's
nice. I'm pleased with that.
Yeah.
I like that. That was nice. Apparently some people contacted Ruth Finney, who is program director for radio now. And she said, we'll give it a try and see if it works. Yeah. So Saturday nights at 7.
It's a great time.
In addition to 11 a.m. on Saturday. So right. I've got you bracketed.
So as I've said, I'm very busy Saturday morning, so I might catch a little of it. And it's so great if I hear something to get that second chance to listen to it. I mean, people, listeners, you can listen to the program online. You get a chance to stream it for a week. But if you don't not inclined to do that, it's just nice to know that you can listen to it again the same day. So it's great.
I'm following them. They can't get away from me. I'm everywhere.
Well, Mike, it's been great.
It's been wonderful, Marianne. Takes us back to the start, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And we're a little fuzzy. I think if I really check the dates, we got a few things confused, but no one else knows.
But November 1980, I know.
That's a definite.
And 89, I know, and 94, I know. But if you ask me when in 89 or 94, I have no idea.
Exactly. So, congratulations on all your accomplishments. Congratulations on all the anniversaries this year. And we look forward to reading your book.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.